I'm Jamie Beebe.
And I'm Jake Deptula. We're the host of Strictly Stalking,
a weekly true crime podcast exploring true stalking stories from survivors in their own words.
We cover unique stalking cases through interviews with stalking survivors, advocates, and experts.
Strictly Stalking has been praised by survivors, advocates, listeners, and media for raising awareness about the dangerously underreported and often fatal crime of stalking.
Our series continues to provide a vital platform for stalking survivors to share their stories.
And provides anti-stalking resources for listeners, along with important tips on how friends, family, and law enforcement can support stalking survivors.
Please listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Morbidology is a weekly true crime podcast hosted by me, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Unsolved Murders, Cults Uncovered, and Mysteries Uncovered.
911 emergency.
My son shot my husband. I need an ambulance. He's bleeding.
Each week on Morbidology, I uncover a new true crime case using investigative research combined with source audio.
I just snatched it from her. My son had took it and it's like, I just hit her with it.
Morbidology is a victim-focused podcast that mostly covers cases that aren't widely documented in mainstream media. I also like to take an in-depth look at any systemic failures which had a part to play in the crime.
Do you know why you're here?
For a home invasion gone terribly wrong.
Listen to Morbidology across all podcast platforms.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I'm your speaker, Casey, and today I'm going to be talking to writer, life coach, and religious abuse advocate Rebecca Drumster about her experiences growing up in Christian fundamentalism, Bill Gothard's Institute in Basic Life Principles, her work around religious trauma and recovery, as well as her writing. Rebecca's book, When Family Hurts, is going to be one of this month's monthly memoir giveaway books, so head over to @CultVaultPod on Twitter and Instagram to see more. It is now less than 6 weeks until CrimeCon UK meets in Glasgow on September 10th for a day of true crime, community and activity. There are only a few tickets left and I would love to see some of you there and meet you in person. You can head over to crimecon.co.uk and use the code CULT at the checkout to get 10% off your own ticket. When I spoke with Rebecca, she was travelling with her family and talking to me from her travelling home, so there are some connection issues throughout, and as usual, this is more of a conversation than an interview. So, with great happiness, I present Rebecca Drumster. So, hello, Rebecca, and thank you for joining me on the show today. I am eager to discuss your life and your work with the listeners, and to bring to each person listening some incredible tools and resources for improving relationships and well-being. Would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners?
Sure thing. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I appreciate it. So my name is Rebecca Drumster, and it's kind of hard to say exactly who I am and what I do, but I am an advocate, an author, a consultant, and I work with individuals who've experienced spiritual abuse and religious trauma. From a variety of backgrounds, whether it's a cult, a church, a family. And it's a passion of mine because of my own lived experiences, and also because I want to help make religion a safe place for my own family, for those coming behind us, because now as we know more, we can do better and create a safer, better, healthier environment going forward.
And that in itself is exactly why I'm so looking forward to us having a conversation today. That just, I know it's idealist in some ways, but the work that you're doing is absolutely moving in that direction. And I'm sure that every person that you work with is then kind of steered in that same direction as well. And it's fantastic. So before we talk about some of your amazing work, I'd like to learn more about you as an individual, if that's okay. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your childhood and your life growing up?
Yeah, so how long are these episodes again? How many hours long? Yes, so I like to say that four different religious cults impacted the foundation of my life. One of the very first memories I have of church or religion is when my family had announced that they were leaving the church that I grew up in. I was maybe 5 years old, And a little girl on the playground came up to me and threw sand in my eyes, which blinded me and scared me to death, and told me that because my family was leaving the church, that we were going to hell, that no one could ever speak to us anymore, and that there was something wrong with my family. And that's my very first memory of church. And I mean, I remember crawling around, you know, when I was little in a lobby, you know, an entry. But other than that, that's my first very distinct memory. And so that is where a lot of things began. And the reason my family was leaving this church community was because the pastor had made it into a cult. He would divide people on Sundays or anytime there was a service and say, if you're with me, you know, stay seated or stand up, whichever he chose. And if you're against me, do the opposite and leave this building and you're not welcome to come back. And no one can speak to you again. And so that happened to our family because we chose to leave. But also connected to that church was a family that was very close to us. And they had left a Mormon sect that was down in Mexico. And because the husband had removed the husband and the mother, but they blamed the husband, is my understanding, because he had taken his family away from this sect and refused to return the children or the wife. They came up from Mexico and he was killed in an atonement killing. And they were very close to our family very close to my parents. And, that is also when I was about 5 years old. So it was a very dramatic and intense time for our family and everyone involved. And again, I learned at around 5 years old that, so if you no longer agree with someone because you leave their church, because you left their faith, because you decided something was better for your family, that you might die, that you could be killed. So my parents moved us from that church environment to what I honestly believe they thought was a healthier, safer place, into a little independent, fundamental Baptist church. And if you have ever seen the podcast, which Eric does a great job, called Preacher Boys, he is revealing a lot of what has been hidden and kept secret within the IFB, or Independent Fundamental Denomination. And so that's where I spent the bulk of my years, was growing up in that church, growing up in a legalistic, Christian fundamentalist, male-dominated, a lot of fear-based experiences through church. There are some beautiful things that I got to do, got to learn, people I still love and I care about that are connected with that church or with my, you know, my those years growing up. But there's no way to say it other than it is a cult denomination. Also, I was homeschooled and my parents joined a program, which I know you've had guests who've been part of this organization, that was founded by Bill Gothard, called IBLP, or the Institute in Basic Life Principles. It started as the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts because Mr. Gothard said that he had identified these specific issues that if you would help resolve them as a youth, that you would not carry all of these wounds and bad stuff into your life as an adult, and that you could help save your children from ever having the same troubles that you went through. So it started out as more of a focus on resolving youth conflicts, but then it quickly changed into a very large global organization with millions of people attending seminars. And I grew up, so in the IFB church, coupled with the IBLP, Gothard homeschool organization, where I did get to travel the world. I did get to see some wonderful things, but not even hidden in the Gothard organization, the pillar of the entire program that we had was something called the umbrella of authority. It was the authoritarian model, this structure that was not even hidden. It was out there in the open and everyone just accepted it. So every single person, unless you were a male or a pastor, has an authority. Your only authority, if you're a male or a pastor, is God. But outside of that, every woman, every child had multiple authorities. And I grew up in such intense fear that anything I did, I would come under an attack from Satan, and that my life would be ruined if I did not obey unquestioningly any authority that was in my life. And this led me to different harmful situations, a lot of confusion. And so I could go into great detail, and that's up to you if you want to know about more specific beliefs and things. But the ultimate within Christian fundamentalism, and this applies to others that could be considered a radical group or a fundamentalist group, is fear. Fear is the basis of all of these beliefs, that the controlling fear. And so I was a fearful person, a fearful child. And that is something that even to this day, I still battle with, are these fears that is this a real fear or is this a perceived fear? And so those are kind of the beginnings of my years until I was in my early 20s when I got married. And that's when my life began to change. And you can go, there's websites, there's one from called Recovering Grace, and there's other websites where you can learn more details about the different organizations. But yeah, that was the first 20 something years of my life.
Oh my goodness. I mean, even the first interaction that you explained to us on your parents' departure from the first group, the story of the young person coming to you and attacking you, when you first hear that, it's so easy to think, how is a child acting that way? But of course, these children are all completely conditioned to think and feel and believe the things that they are saying to you as they kind of attack you, that you wonder what on earth is going on in that child's life for them to behave that way. That's terrifying. First of all, no children should ever behave in that way. And for you to be the on the receiving end of that must have been so confusing. You just said you've come from Texas, so I don't even know what your thoughts and feelings are around what is going on politically, the climate over there in terms of things that are going on, and how that's actually going to impact your work as a professional.
I definitely do have my own opinions, but I don't speak about them publicly because my goal is not to tell people what to think. I want them to learn how to think. And when you come from a high demand group, a cult, a controlling religious church, or church or background, you've been told what to think so often. And that, again, we're back to fear-based. So many things that are happening in politics in Texas and around the United States are based in fear or based in someone trying to tell us what to do and how to do it, or again, trying to control behavior through something. And so it's always asking a lot of questions. Why am I afraid? Why is this bothering me? What is the root behind this? So learning to ask a lot of questions and not getting caught up in a fear-based moments or emotion, or letting the media decide what you're going to think or how you're going to vote or how, you know, all of these things. And also, So again, I don't share my own personal beliefs because I want you to begin to develop yours. I want you to be able to think for yourself. And my views, I mean, even in recent days, I'm still learning and I'm still changing. I'm still growing. And I hope that as you, if you're a listener, if you're freshly out of a high demand group, that you understand, like, you don't have to hurry. You do not have to quickly change your mind about everything. There's time. And we can get caught up so quickly in realizing this is hurtful and that was devastating. This is controlling. This is fear-based. And before you know it, you're kind of in a tizzy and you're spinning out of control. There's the little Tasmanian devil in the Looney Tunes cartoons, and he spins and spins and creates this little, you know, cyclone, this little whirling. And that's how it feels when we're watching all these new laws being passed and these new, why is this happening? And I don't know what I think about this anymore. What do I believe? And it's calm down, take time. Historically, when you read from history, when you read the history of science, when you read the history of religion, this has happened before. This is history repeating itself, where science and religion and politics are competing, they're conflicting, they're fighting, they're creating turmoil and strife among people. And so keeping a cool head and calmly knowing that we can move forward, don't get caught up in the panic. And
I think that's great advice. I mean, once our episode airs, I'm not sure what the outcome will be or how the overall kind of vibe will be, if things will carry on intensifying in certain ways with various groups kind of interlinking with one another in some parts of America. There's no way to know kind of how that's going to go, but I think your insight into some of the steps that we can take to manage these stresses when we feel them, and these moments of kind of in our heads of psychological panic and the need to kind of do something quickly physically to kind of manage the Tasmania devil running around, that is something that I think is transparent in the work that you've published, which we will speak about in detail later on. And I could see, if you were to return to the chapter in the book that's relevant to time, slowing down, you know, nothing needs to be done in a hurry, I think then you'd be able to go through that process with the steps that kind of help you to do that, instead of just like stress laxing, where you try to relax and actually you're just getting more stressed out. And my next question was going to be whether it was one of these interactions or one of these experiences that you had in your childhood that led you to the work that you do now, or led you to have what you would term, or what you have coined the term as, a spiritual identity disruption. But of course, from the introduction you gave us, it sounds as if all four experiences had a hand in creating that outcome for you, and kind of the crescendo of you experiencing the spiritual identity disruption in its entirety. So could you explain to the listeners what the term is, how you coined it, what it means, and how it applied to you at the time you realized that you were going through something that perhaps wasn't definable elsewhere at that time?
So the term spiritual identity disruption, I'd heard a friend and colleague, Dr. Paula at Bethel, speaking at a conference, and she was talking about identity and how our identities are disrupted in different times of our lives. And especially during part of the other work I do with surprise DNA discoveries. And that was kind of where she was focusing her talk. And I began realizing, just listening to her talk, that is what has happened to me. My identity as a person, as a woman, as, you know, as a Christian, as a spiritual person, as a mom, as a wife, my identity had been completely turned upside down. And so I began noticing patterns, and I'm an observer. I'm a seer. I look and I listen and I watch. I notice patterns, and I started seeing all of these patterns that had been experienced in my own life. And then whether it was a client or a friend, or people I was reading about and seeing their stories online. And I saw this very distinct pattern. And so a word that has become popular in these spaces is deconstruction. And so that was the only word I knew of at the time that was helping people, that was giving a language to what they were experiencing. And while, we can probably talk about this later, I had experienced my own faith deconstruction, it was not a word that fully captured what I had lived through, what my family was living through because of my changing beliefs and questions. And so, again, I saw these patterns. I heard my friend speaking at the conference, and this just came to me. This is what is happening. It is a spiritual identity disruption. And I defined that term as, spiritual identity disruption is when what you believed or were taught about faith or spirituality collide with an opposing lived experience, which may include abuse, trauma, and hypocrisy. This polarization cannot be reconciled using the existing foundation, thus causing a disruption of identity and crisis of belief.
I think I emailed you when I stumbled across that term and had to ask you if that terminology was something that you were responsible for, because I read it and it just encapsulated everything that I'd been trying to do myself.
Deconstruction, how I view it, how the majority of people that I interact with have viewed it, is deconstruction is like science. It's systematically piecing apart what you believe, why you believe it, and then analyzing that to see, does this cause harm? Is this healthy? Is this accurate? Is this a good belief? And then that is what deconstruction is. It's more of a systematic piecing apart, looking under a microscope to see what is harmful, what is toxic, what is healthy, what is good, what is ugly, what is evil. And so that is more, so that's why deconstruction, yes, I've experienced and walked through that, but it wasn't the whole picture. It wasn't, oh my goodness, this is impacting my family. This is, you know, it did not express the whole thing. So again, spiritual identity disruption and deconstruction, I believe, do go hand in hand.
Absolutely. From what you've said there, it really sounds like that's the missing piece to everything that deconstruction doesn't manage to capture. And it also sounds like deconstruction is a necessary thing, because there must be,
absolutely,
when somebody's belief system crashes in such a way, and that's all you've known your entire life or for a prolonged period of time, the question of your entire reality must come into play. And so there's this kind of journey of trying to say, well, what do I believe in then? And what do I know is inherently 100% real and fact, and what isn't? How is it that you educate people on this terminology?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can speak at events. I've spoken at conferences on this topic. I'm looking toward the future, possibly doing some more video style things. I'm not sure yet, but I walk through this with my clients. And so this is one of the things that we do walk through when someone comes to me and they begin expressing, and everyone's at a different place in their journey and their healing and their processing. And so, but so far to date, this has been very helpful for each one of my clients. And so I do hope to do more speaking and writing on this and offering additional resources connected with spiritual identity disruption. But I did want to also circle back to what you were saying about some of the positives that can come from being raised in a cult background, high demand group. I would preface that by also saying a high demand group or a cult is always dangerous. It is never optimal. It is never what anybody would want or should want. It is not a healthy or a safe place. But we have to remember our parents, or if we were the ones who took, most people right now were raised in something and they're recognizing their parents took them into it. Not as many people are the ones who made the choice to join the cult or high demand group, but that definitely they do exist. But it's the biggest trick, one of the oldest tricks in the book. Every single human being is susceptible to falling prey to a high demand group or a cult. So I believe having some empathy, or at least having some understanding of why your parents joined this organization, or why your family was, or why giving grace to yourself if you're the one who made that decision. Because again, it's the oldest con in the book. You're going to get suckered into it because we are humans. And that's what we do. We're looking for answers because we're hurting. And so looking for the positive, you know, for me, there was a lot of focus on family communications. We love children. There were these good elements that after I got through the ugly, the hurtful, the toxic, the nasty, the manipulative, the controlling, all the bad side, if I did not look at the good, it would have destroyed me. It would have made me into a bitter, nasty human. And I did not want those cults and those mindsets to win. I couldn't do that. So if I did not say, you know what, had I not traveled the world and taught and done these mission things and done all of this, you know, I could not have landed where I am today, because that is what helped me start seeing out, was these experiences. And I mean, while it's tricky to write a resume when you have the first 20-something years of your life and a cult type of background, and your education comes from fundamental places, you know, how do you pick up those pieces? But I think if we don't stop and see where is the good, then that is part of letting the evil win. And I wasn't about to do that. Evil doesn't get to win with me. And it might fight me really hard, but it doesn't get to win.
I just love your kind of like an insight into how your mind works is incredible. And it's like your book and your website and everything. It literally is, that's what you resonate in real life. And sometimes it's like, hey, I'm here selling a package. This is what you can expect from me if you come to, you know, one-to-one sessions with me. But I can see immediately why clients would benefit from sitting down with you and having these discussions. It's amazing. And
thank you. I don't want to sell you anything. I just want to help you. I am not here to sell. And I say that on my website, like if it is finances and that's the only reason you're not reaching out because you need help, please email me. Do not be ashamed. I have needed financial help in my life before, and I care about your soul and your future more than I care about 50 or 60 bucks.
Oh. So. And when you have new clients come through, do you find yourself often reminded of yourself or when you see people in certain stages of their own recovery or their own journey to recovery?
That's a great question. I do. I think we forget how far we've come. I forget when I, you know, talk to somebody from my past for the first time in 15 years. I forget who I used to be, what I used to believe, how hard the struggle was. And so, but that's a good thing for me personally, because that means I have grown, I've changed, I've learned. I'm becoming who I was supposed to be, who I am, not the little perfect wearing long skirts and listening to this type of music and, you know, saying yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, and obeying any man who came around. And I wasn't that little submissive, oh, girl, I didn't fit that mold anyway. And that's why it was so painful for me to grow up that way. Who I really was fighting. But yes, there are certain clients that I've had who I see, this was me 14 years ago. This was me 12 years ago. And, that gives me hope though, because these are people, and it is a majority so far of my clients have been women, but I see this strength that has never been allowed to come out. This strength, this resolve, this courage that I have felt alone in having, and I'm seeing this current of women who are saying, I'm not raising my babies this way. I'm not putting up with this anymore. This is toxic. This is unhealthy. And they range. Some people may still identify as Christian. Some people may not. But they are still saying, I am moving forward to healthy. I am moving forward to where I get to make these decisions. They are not being made for me. They are empowering themselves by seeking health, seeking to come out of these controlling environments.
Wow. I think women are so strong. I didn't even realize what I was capable of until I had children. And I just, you know, my partner, if he talks about it, he just wells up and starts crying. But I just think that there is a strength inside. I mean, I can't speak for other genders, but there is a strength inside of women that is just, it's like bottled up and it's there and it will come out when it needs to. And it must be incredible for you to see people go through those transition periods and taking back that power and that strength and allowing themselves to really express it in a safe environment.
That moment of realization when they feel free And often it's just that one belief, that one hang up, that one thing. And so, yes, I mean, there's thousands of issues, thousands of things that we end up changing our minds about, and thousands is probably maybe not the right number. But that moment when you have that first release of a toxic belief or about yourself, about the world, about the Bible, about whatever it may be, when you realize that, that moment of release and freedom, when I've been able to be on the either on a Zoom call or by telephone or in person with somebody, when they have that moment, it's the most amazing experience, because then you see what it feels like. And this is why I'm doing this. This is why I'm putting in this hard work, facing my abuses, facing my traumas, facing all this hard, ugly, painful stuff. Because that moment when your soul becomes uncaged and you know what it feels like to fly free, it's beautiful. It's amazing.
Do you have your own therapist whilst you're working with people that may present to you things that trigger you or make you kind of relive certain parts of your previous trauma?
Mm-hmm. I have had many therapists in the last 15 years. Right now I have a coach. She is a retired marriage and family therapist with a PhD in psychology, I believe. And so I have really clicked with her, really connected with her. And so she's the person that I can call and say, all right, I got to process this. Something came up and I thought I'd healed, or this reminded me of this situation or this event. And I think that's part of it, is as far out as we get, and for me, it's about 14 years away from it, but it is always going to hurt. There's always going to be miscarriages. And so for a woman who has lost a child at any stage, you know that that pain doesn't go away forever. And so at some point, some little thing will bring tears to your eyes or bring that grief back into your chest. And so that's the same way it is when you leave behind a toxic, controlling, high demand group. No matter how long away you are, how strong you've become, how much you've learned, there's always going to be those moments, and something will trigger you, or you'll realize, I still believe that. I'm still operating from that basis. I did not realize that. I thought I'd worked through that. Also, you begin to discover a bias. Anybody who's a Christian fundamentalist, anybody who's and calls, you suddenly realize, oh my goodness, my husband has to remind me of this all the time. Rebecca, that's your bias speaking. Like, oh man, but it's the opposite way. It's against those who caused harm, those who were hurtful, but yet, why are you still teaching this? Why are you still preaching this? It's, you know, there's science now that proves that this was a harmful teaching. But yes, I still have to speak to somebody. I believe it's healthy for all of us, even if we're in a healthy, you know, stage in life. I think we need to check in with a professional, somebody who can, you know, we can ask questions to or run things by. I don't think you ever need to stop checking in with someone who understands psychology and your background. I think that's the healthiest thing we can do.
I think that's great advice as well. Even just kind of applying that to my own experiences, I can see why that would be hugely beneficial. On a day-to-day basis, you could feel like you're kind of, you know, really good and steady and feeling like you're really taking care of your own positive well-being. And then it could just be one night of bad sleep. And the next day it's like, you just want to throw everything out the window, like a really kind of give up mentality, or really kind of a depressed mentality where you don't want to do anything at all. You don't want to eat, you don't want to wash. And it could be anything.
Were you at my house last week? Is that what it was? Well, you're not immune to it, because we have our own lived experiences, our own hurts. And then for you, you hear these stories. For me, I have the clients, and you think you've heard it all. And then someone tells you something that is so bad, for lack of a better word, so difficult, so abusive, what they have had to survive. And it does. You go, I can't do this anymore. This is too hard. Like, And what about me? I need to check in with somebody. This is hurting me too. But again, I don't want the evil to win. This ugly stuff doesn't get to win. And if I have this tiny little corner and I have five people that are listening to me, I'm gonna keep talking.
Because I don't want
my daughter to ever have to experience the things that I experienced. And so, yeah.
Everything that you've just said there, 100%.
Your own humanness surfaces. And there's that word that we were using before we started recording, that imposter syndrome, that no matter how successful we become, no matter how many people we've helped, no matter the degrees we have mounted on our walls, whatever the success is, whatever we deem as success, whether that's through relationships, through accomplishments, through our own self-work, there's still this imposter syndrome that doesn't ease up. And I have it. I know people that are extremely successful that you look at them and say, how do you have imposter syndrome? Really? But that is also, though, from what I'm seeing, those who are survivors of cults, of high demand groups, there's a lot of us with imposter syndrome. Because we've been told we were nothing, that we were not capable of doing anything in and of ourselves, that we needed the group, that we needed the leader, that we needed this belief, that we needed this whatever. And so that imposter syndrome, I often say that, like, I was wired to have imposter syndrome. It was literally ingrained in me. You're worthless. You're nothing. You can't do anything. Some of it's because you're a woman. Some of it's because in order to control you through the biblical spiritual teachings, what they labeled as biblical teachings.
I was taught that anything good I did, all my righteousness, was as a filthy rag to God.
You had to see yourself as worthless. You were a filthy rag. They would tell us, and I mean, as if we're talking about women, there's a story in the scriptures where it talks about the filthy rags. And those were these cloths that were filthy that had to be used and then thrown away. And women were sent outside of the city in old custom while they were on their periods. And those were these cloths. So our sins and who we are as a filthy rag. So talk about a female's identity. Everything I do, who I am, the sins that I commit, they're somehow connected, to the very most intimate part of those are those things that imposter syndrome is so common for survivors because, and again, each group has told you something different about your self-worth or your value or your identity or what you're capable of doing. And for me, I had to get as a yucky pad that you throw in the trash on your period. Like, so I know that sounds gross and I'm sorry if that's too weird of a detail, but that is literally a belief that people have that you have to process through.
It's not a disgusting detail. I don't think it's something that's important to discuss on the show, especially when I speak to a lot of women who were never taught what their menstrual cycles were. And when they came to that time of the month or experiencing it for the first time, it was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to die. Like a visceral reaction to this natural thing happening.
Hey, I've experienced that too.
It's awful. I don't understand how something that when the mentality of a lot of these high demand groups is that women have a quiver full of children, they have a quiver full family, they have more and more and more kids, yet women's menstrual cycles are disgusting. And the men that preach that women's dirty rags because of their menstrual cycles should exist outside of the city, that's how these preachers and pastors are here. That's how you're here. Like, you wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for women having menstrual cycles. So it doesn't make sense.
There's so much circular reasoning. I'm of the opinion now that when you don't teach your daughters about their own bodies, I believe that's abusive. When you don't teach your children about sex, that's abusive because they don't know the situations they can get into, the things that might happen to them. They need to be aware. So not knowing just the basic science and anatomy of your own body at very basics, I see that as abusive because you are not allowing them to be who they are, who they were born to be. If you're a woman, if you're a female, you're going to have a cycle. Like, that's just a fact of science. And so to ignore those things and to make you feel shameful and like it's dirty and disgusting, I feel like that's a form of abuse. Well, there was even a teaching back in through IBLP that talked about if a husband were to have sex with his wife while she's on her period, that it can cause cancer. There are these teachings about when you can and cannot have sex with your wife. I've seen the paperwork for that. And if we need to, we can probably find it in a file somewhere. But that was one of the teachings. And so, yes, there were teachings about, I mean, modesty. When you're talking about walking around without hardly any clothes in the hospital, yeah, no, that wouldn't happen for a woman from one of these groups because you have to be modest. And for me, even with my own birth story, if we start talking about deconstruction again and when all that started for me, that plays into it. This modesty thing, my body couldn't give birth because I was so concerned with being modest, with who was going to be looking at and touching my body. It was this trauma that I could not get over. That was one of the steps that led me into that deconstruction of my faith. And yeah, it all does play into, and the more we talk, the more little things like this, like you believed what, why would they even teach you? Why would anybody say anything about that? You know, this concepts of spanking your children until they cry so that you can break their will. People who were, it was taught for them to be spanked bare bottom, you know, shame, humiliation behind those things. And so many more places we can go on the teaching with fundamentalism, with IBLP, with all of this that people can relate to. And often we're ashamed to talk about that because I'm not sure how to use this expression. It was a sin done against our souls. Sometimes people can understand that because when you've been shamed that way, it has affected your very core of who you are. And it was something done to you that you could not control. It was this trauma as a child, whether how you were disciplined or how you viewed your body, as a woman, all of those things. Those were those unhealthy, horrible things that were done to us that affect our psyche, that affect our emotions, that affect our physical health. As a woman, so many women struggle with infertility, with weight issues, with hormone struggles, with unexplained illnesses. So there's this distinct pattern for women leaving toxic groups and their health now as adults. And yeah, it can get pretty ugly pretty fast. Why are they going there? Why were they teaching us that?
There were so many things when I was reading Heather Grace Heath's book, Lovingly Abused. There were so many points where I out loud was like, what does, I think the blanket training was one of the parts that stuck with me the most, because at the time of reading her book, my baby was the age where the blanket training would be encouraged to be actually implemented.
Yes. Oh, the blanket training. Yes. And infants have to be modest. Infant females must be modest because that can also make their sibling brothers or other men stumble if an infant is not covered from head to toe, and no boys can be nearby if there's a diaper change, and you know, all of those things.
Well, with my little girl about to turn one and the days getting a bit warmer and longer here, it's my favorite thing to have her to be just in her nappy, just out around and about, crawling around and just having a nice squishy nudie baby about the house. It's lovely. It's unfortunate to hear of all of these experiences that so many people miss out on because of the strange beliefs of man put into these teachings in the way that their interpretation of the Bible leads them to believe that infants can't be, you know, just in their little rompers or their little nappies and just kind of existing happily.
A newborn has been sexualized. They are making our children into sexual objects.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get my head around.
It's a means of control. It is another means of domination and control. And if you can control the very most
natural thing of a woman's body, which is to change and have a period or to have a baby or to be, you know, of course you can control them psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, physically. So it's just another one of the control mm-hmm. tactics. I know Steve Hassan talks about that authoritarian control with his BITE model, behavior, information, thought, and emotion control. And that's just another one of those elements.
And you mentioned briefly there your own experiences through deconstruction. And at some point it must have put you towards further education to go from having the homeschooled, I say in air quotes, the homeschool education that you had. I don't know if that was different for you than it was for some of the other people that we've spoken to on the show in terms of parents overseeing actually what you're learning. But what is your deconstruction like? Can you kind of talk us through it in briefly, kind of what it looked like mm-hmm. from leaving those movements up to attending further education and deciding to go into the work that you are now existing in?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. So yes, I was raised to believe that college was not necessary, especially as a woman. Your husband would provide for you. You didn't need, you know, to go to college. If I was interested in college, there was only one or two universities that I would have been allowed to go to, and that would have been PCC, Pensacola Christian College, or Bob Jones University. And PCC was the one everybody in our church went to. So that was where, if I went to college, I had to go there. And finally, once I reached toward the ends of my high school years, my parents did kind of switch their beliefs a little bit on that and say, yeah, you maybe do need some sort of continuing education. What if your husband dies one day and you do have to do something? And so it was a bit confusing to go, wait, I thought college wasn't necessary to, I need to do something. I refused to go to PCC because I'd been there for a summer camp and decided that, yeah, that was a bit much for me. And so, yeah, I had, again, there were some positives. I made a lot of friends. I had a lot of experiences through my homeschool years. During, you know, high school and early college age, that's when I did a lot of my IBLP stuff, where I got to travel and live overseas and, you know, work for a government as an English teacher and do all of these things. And so I, on my own, figured out a way to do some distance learning. Distance learning had just started, and I was able to get my degrees. And after I was married, I got my master's degree because I wanted to. I always had an interest in learning, even though I'd been helped to understand that I was not that smart, and my interest in law or politics or medicine was probably not within my reach. And, you know, playing the piano, teaching children, those sort of things were a better idea for me. Maybe being a missionary, being a pastor's wife. And so once I was married, I was able to finish up a master's degree. And again, it's not from an accredited university, but I do have a master's degree. And I have always loved learning and reading and thinking. And so, yeah, my deconstruction phase started with the birth of my daughter. As I hinted at earlier, a traumatic birth with this trauma in my body, literally not allowing me to give birth, holding on to my daughter as tightly as I could. And I thought a home birth was the only way to go, that was the right biblical, godly way to give birth. So we started at home. And then we, which still, if it's by choice, because it's what you want to do, is an empowering thing for you as a woman, I would support that. But for me, I thought it was the only choice. I thought it was the only way. And, but I ended up in the hospital with a C-section where I felt them cutting me open. And I felt as though I was laying down my life for my child. And it was this horrible experience. I'm laying there in bed finally with a three-day-old baby. And I look over at her face and I just remember, I went, does God even exist?
Wow.
I prayed the prayers. My husband was reading scripture to me. We did the right things. The home birth was the right way to do it. And yet all of these horrible traumatic things happened. God, you abandoned me. I did it right and I had a horrible outcome. I'd been promised if I followed these rules, followed this system, that the outcome I wanted, this is what it would be. And so that was that moment for me of this crisis of faith as a first-time mom with a newborn, recovering physically and emotionally from a horrible birth, to saying, I don't even know what I believe.
Wow.
That was also the moment when I looked at my child and said, how can I raise her and tell her that she's evil and disgusting and horrible? I can't do that. And so all of these questions started colliding. And that is when my faith deconstruction began. And when I lived in India, when I was younger, I began seeing some things that were not consistent the way that the Christians were there. I'd met a woman who became a Christian, and I went back the next year, and she'd been killed by her family because she's converted to Christianity. People would walk barefoot for miles to come to a service on a Sunday. Women could show their bellies, but they had to cover their ankles. And for us, we had to cover our bellies, but we could show our ankles. And I began seeing these inconsistencies as, you know, 19, 20, 21 year old. And yeah, they were always like, whatever. It's just the way they do it. But this is the right way. We do it the right way. Their culture's wrong. We do it the right way. And so I lay in bed with this newborn, and those things that I observed that I began, it all collided into that moment. That disruption of, I'd been taught this, I'd been told this, but what I've experienced in my life, the pain, the suffering that I've just gone through, everything I've been promised, it did not match. It did not, what I was experiencing, it did not match. Something was off. And so that is where that deconstruction began for me. So first time mom, who's also now questioning everything I'd ever been taught, everything I'd ever believed, goodness. Down to the existence of God. And that's how my parenting journey began. And so I often say I've been growing up alongside my daughter. And it scared me at first, you know, as many other moms, like, am I going to ruin my child? Am I hurting my child? A lot of moms put off changing their minds or deconstructing because they're afraid they're going to hurt their kids or ruin their families. I didn't. I couldn't. And I only see good things. My daughter is strong. She's independent. She knows her own mind. She's respectful, but yet she will question authority if she does not understand or needs clarification or doesn't want to do it, which is healthy. It's a good thing. She's not a follower. And, you know, but there were struggles with my marriage, with my family relationships, with the friends that I'd grown up with that I'd known for, you know, 20 years, 25 years. And, you know, the moment I remember, my husband would take our little one to church and I would get her all dressed up and put that big bow in her hair. And then I would close the door and I would sink down behind my front door and sob for an hour, sometimes half an hour, sometimes an hour, 2 hours, because I felt so conflicted. There, my whole body had this response because all I ever knew was church. All I ever knew was Christianity. All I ever knew was all this stuff. And here there was this war, this battle inside of me. I didn't start it. I didn't pick this. It happened to me. And I wanted to go to church, but I couldn't. And when I did, I had a physical response. I would be ill. I would cry for 2 or 3 days. I would have headaches. I would have all, so I was having a physical response to trying to go to church. And if I didn't, I would still cry because it was this battle of my soul. It was this battle of my mind, my soul, my emotions. And I wanted to do what was right. I wanted to do what was true, what was good, but I couldn't trust anybody. So this was about 14 years ago when the word deconstruction didn't exist. There, I mean, perhaps it did because, what, how do you pronounce his name? Derrida. His book existed, but of course I hadn't heard of it. There were all of these resources that were there, but I didn't know who to trust. And so I began doing it all on my own. I began asking questions quietly, reading new books, doing everything by myself. And I began to notice that there were other people who would start doing the same thing. I had to step out of church for several years. I could not attend church. It was too traumatic. It was too painful. I had to detox from that environment, from the language, all the churchy words that everybody used. I had to discover who God was, if God was, and what it was going to look like for me, if what faith was going to mean for me going forward. And thankfully, eventually, years later, there was this word called deconstruction that people started using. But for the most part, and you know, deconstruction wasn't a thing until I'd already stepped into starting to help other people. And then it made sense. Oh, that's what I was going through by myself and figuring it out, thinking I was the only one. But people started coming to me. They started asking questions. Strangers. I was sitting in a pool one day and this stranger just struck up a conversation and she's in the middle of the same thing, questioning her faith, questioning her background. People just started coming out of nowhere. And so I did. I ended up going. I have two different life coaching certifications. I wanted to make sure that I was educated. And anyway, so yeah, I began my own process, my own journey, which led me to further education. And I'm still learning. I still go to conferences, still take courses and classes. I never want to stop learning so that I can help others and not harm them.
That kind of leads us perfectly into talking about your published book, When Family Hurts, which does exist in print today. You can get your hands on it. I've had the opportunity to actually read through a copy of Rebecca's book. But I wonder, I mean, if you could talk the listeners through what the book is, what it offers, the layout, and all of the themes included inside the book, but also, when did you decide to write it? Why did you decide to include the things that you did and break the book down in the way that it's done? And all of the stuff that kind of comes with your reasoning for the book's existence and then what the book's existence offers everybody else.
Yeah. I know a lot of authors say this, but I wrote the book that I needed, but I couldn't find, which is true. There was a very big moment in my life when I needed help and nobody could help me. And I needed some answers pretty quick and I didn't know where to go. I couldn't find resources. And while I was, you know, seeing a therapist and I did go to therapy every week or every other week, and it still wasn't quite what I needed, because sometimes when we're in the middle of situations, we have to make a decision fast. We don't have the luxury of a year of therapy to make up our minds. There's not all situations that allow us to do that. And so I developed When Family Hurts, 30 Days to Finding Healing and Clarity. And it is a 30-day guide where you get to become your own coach. It's a self-coaching guide. And it is written where there are 30 different topics. And each topic, whether whatever it may be, those are things that I myself had to process through. Those are elements of this difficult time in my own family that I had to process through, the questions that I've had to answer. And so each day there will be a quote from someone. Then there's a section, not very long, that I have written on the topic. And then there's a daily challenge, something that I want you to physically go do. And then there's reflection questions, things for you to ask yourself to get to understand yourself and your situation better, to have that awareness, to get to gain some clarity. And so the very front of the book, there's a check-in section where you can just kind of keep track. Well, I'm still really mad about this today. Or, oh my goodness, I had a breakthrough. Or, I didn't realize that I was operating from this belief about myself or about my family. And so, or, you know, I need to work on this a little bit more. And so you kind of check in with yourself at the beginning, but it's a 30-day process. It should not take you more than, I don't know, what, 10 or 15 minutes, unless you want to commit more time to the process. But I want you to write in the book, journal, take notes, unless that's not your thing, then just read it. But it's that 30-day guide. So at the end of 30 days, I really hope that whatever you're struggling through with your family, whether it's an abusive situation, whether it's you have a narcissistic mother or sister, whether you're making a decision that will impact your family, whether maybe your family does not approve of a life choice that you've made, or you've made an unexpected discovery through DNA testing. You have just revealed to your family that you're leaving the unhealthy religious group that you were raised in. Whatever the situation might be, I hope that you'll be able to, in 30 days, have some of those answers that you need, that you'll be able to understand yourself and your situation better so that you can make those decisions going forward. Does this involve therapy? Does this involve making this decision that, you know, puts these boundaries in place? Does it, whatever that result is, I just hope that, again, the healing, the clarity, the awareness, that those are those things that you'll be able to achieve at the end of the 30 days.
It's an incredible book, such a wonderful resource, and really accessible for anybody that's been through any type of negative family experience, which I imagine is every single person in the world. So
yeah, just a little
what
bit.
What I loved, first of all, I loved the love chapter with Katharine Hepburn's quote at the start, which says, "Love has nothing to do with what you are expecting to get, only with what you are expecting to give, which is everything." That is such an incredible quote, because that is what you do when you love someone. You give them everything. Yes. And kind of resonates with your looking over at your newborn baby girl and realizing that that is what you were about to do, was give her everything, which meant yes. changing everything that you had known everything. Up until that point, which is the strength of a woman coming through there, I think. But the book is great. I mean, I didn't have the physical copy, but I could feel myself itching to like get a pen and paper and write in the book, because that really is my type of learning style. I don't know if it's because I feel like I've really achieved something if I've just written it down. If I could type 10 pages on my laptop and then write 10 pages in a book, I'd feel like I've done so much more if I've written it down, and things really tend to stick with me that way. So your book was like, it had me like the inner organizer yes. in me was like, yes, I really want to get involved with this book. But I found it helpful.
And I'm not a journaler. I don't like journaling, so I won't call this a journal. I've had some people call it a workbook. Some people call it a journal. For me, it's just 30 days of self-coaching. And again, you are in charge of that journey. You get to write in there or not. You get to take notes and take it even farther or not. But this is your journey that you get to decide, what are you going to do with these 30 days? And here's these 30 topics, 30 challenges, 30, you know, sets of questions. Now you're in charge. You get yeah. to lead this and find some control that way in a maybe confusing situation.
I don't see how somebody could get to the end of that and not have had at least one thing that they're able to pinpoint or reflect on and say, oh, I realize why I feel this way about this person when it comes to loss or shame or grief. Mm-hmm. And so the book, I think it really is any of the listeners interested in kind of going through that process. The book is available now, When Family Hurts, and we'll make sure that we go through all the places that you can find Rebecca's work before we finish up here today. You've also got your website, which speaks a lot about SID, as I shortened it, spiritual identity disruption. And there's a lot of different resources and things on your website as well, so you can really get an idea of the type of help that somebody might be able to access if they were to come to you. So I didn't know if you wanted to just talk us through your website as well.
Sure. So yes, my website's RebeccaDrumsta.com, my name. And I'm adding resources as I go. My resource page is not super, super large at this point, but I am adding more. But I have written a lot of articles. One of them is actually, there's an adverse religious experience questionnaire. If you're not sure if what you've experienced is healthy or not in a religious setting, whether that's from a pastor, a priest, a spiritual leader, whatever that might be, in a church, a community, there's a questionnaire they can go find. It's called the Adverse Religious Experiences Questionnaire. There's articles on how to identify spiritual abuse in families. If you're going through deconstruction and it's hurting your marriage, how do you deconstruct without losing your marriage? There's several different topics that I try to cover. And again, I'm still adding more and more. And there is more on spiritual identity disruption as well. There's the resource page. There's all of my blog posts. You can order my book there. And if you have any questions, you can email me through my website. And I'd love to be able to connect with you that way, or social media.
I'll make sure that I add all the links to these things that we're discussing as well into the episode description so that people can find it easily if that's something that they wish to do. And the next thing that I wanted to talk about, because you're a woman that wears many hats, all of them are hats that help others, which is amazing. And actually how I came across your work in the first place, you're actually on the board for the Vashti Initiative. And I wondered if you could talk us through how you ended up in that position, what the initiative is. I know it's been mentioned by Heather Grace Heath on a previous episode when I spoke to her, and she said that a portion of the profits from her book, Lovingly Abused, go to the initiative. But if you could just talk us through all of those great things and the service that people might want to access if it's appropriate for them.
Yes, yes. Vashti was founded by survivors. It is also a volunteer-led nonprofit with the mission to empower and assist those fleeing or transitioning out of religious and spiritual abuse. There's several different ones that are offered. One is a monthly Sunday support virtual meetup. So they'll offer, there's links and all that. You can go once a month. There's a Vashti book club. Then we read through different books that are important for healing or for growth or for change or, you know, coming out of a cult or religious abuse. There's a victims fund. If there's an emergency situation where someone needs to escape, you can apply to a victims fund. There's a hotline. You can call if you need resources, if you have questions, if you're not sure what's going on in your own situation and just need to talk to somebody, you can call our hotline. And there's resource navigation assistance. Often you recognize that you are in a harmful or dangerous or unhealthy situation and you just like, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do next. You can call the hotline and they will also be able to assist you in navigating. What are the resources? Where are you? Who can help in your specific situation? Are there websites? Are there books? Are there people? Are there counselors? Like, who do you need to talk to? Who, what do you need? And so those are there. We have big plans, big visions for going forward. But right now there's that book club, the support meeting online, the victims fund hotline, and then of course, all the assistance that you need coming out. So
absolutely incredible, like support on various different levels. And then the board is made up of people, you know, who help people further as well. So what the Vashti Initiative maybe isn't able to offer currently, although I have no doubts that it will go full hog at some point, you can access through, you know, going through the list of people on the board, such as yourself, finding you then in your work and realizing that, you know, there's then another level of support that you can access through the people involved in making this initiative work and exist in the first place. It's just absolutely incredible. That's vashtiinitiative.org. I will include that in the episode description as well for anybody that would like to go and visit the website or access the resources. And how is it that you became a member of the board, and how can any of the listeners, if they're interested, get involved in supporting or volunteering with the initiative?
Absolutely. I saw that there was a need for another board member, and it was completely in line with my own mission, with my own work. And I was able to apply for a board member position. And went through the interview process, and they accepted me as a member. And so I've only been on the board a very short amount of time, but I've already been very impressed with the professionalism and the care, the concern, and the passion behind every individual that I've met. And yes, we're always looking for volunteers for Vashti, and you'll be trained. You'll have the tools, the resources you need, and you can go to vashtiinitiative.org to learn more or to volunteer. You could also call the hotline 1-833-4-VASHTI, V-A-S-H-T-I, and you can get connected with somebody there. The hotline is normally for people who are needing help, but yeah, just go there. You can learn more about how you can help, how you can assist individuals, how you can assist the organization. And again, we are a recognized nonprofit and a volunteer-run organization.
When you came across the initiative and all of the things that it offers, did it occur to you that all of the resources that people can access through this didn't exist when you were going through your journey out of religion, and how great it would have been if you would have been able to access that at your time of deconstruction?
Yes. When I saw that the Vashti Initiative existed, I was very excited because there was finally a place people could go, because I would Google unquestioning my faith. And the only thing that would come up is, well, have more faith in God. Read this Bible verse. Just trust God. And so there was no place that I could go. There was no safe space where I could ask questions or to say, I'm questioning this and I don't know what articles I should read or what books are even available. Because at first I was not in an environment where that was safe for me to even begin asking those types of questions or have those type of books in my possession. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it was wonderful to see that finally somebody is stepping up, they're doing something, they're raising awareness, they're supporting individuals. And if you are a survivor of religious trauma, spiritual abuse, you're not alone. There's an organization here that, because there are so many people who are seeing this and recognizing it in their lives, there's an entire organization that now exists to do something to help you and to help everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And I could see why a Heather would decide to fund or to pledge part of the percentage of her book sales to different nonprofits and organizations helping people that have been in the positions that you and Heather have been in. And I don't know how you can, you know, come across something like the Vashti Initiative and not be like, wow, this is everything that didn't exist during my time of coming out of the group. Yes. And how amazing it must be to be able to say to people, you're having this experience or you're having these experiences. This is what I do with my work, but this is also what the Vashti Initiative does. And just to be able to even just direct people towards resources is really a wonderful thing.
It is. But
what are your plans for the future? You talked about wanting to do more around your spiritual identity disruption work. Is that kind of what your main focus will be moving forward? Do you have any major plans in the pipeline? Any more writing?
Any more writing? Let me think. Yes. Yes, I'm already well into writing my next book, which will be more focused with the religious trauma, spiritual abuse. And I just want to continue listening to the needs. Where can I help the most? Mm-hmm. And right now it's a lot of raising awareness, a lot of letting people know they are not alone. Like I said, I just joined up with Vashti, and I just want to keep finding more ways. And if I can't find a way, we'll create a way, which is what I did. Well, here's a website. I can't find anything. Let me start writing about it. And so, more of doing what I've been doing. I am a mom, so I can't do this 100% full time. And I do some other things too. So it's not 100% full time, but it is the thing other than my family that is tied closely to my heart because of what I've experienced. And so, yes, writing another book. And now I have an agent. So with When Family Hurts, that was done hybrid. And now because of that book, I have an agent.
Amazing.
And so we are still moving forward with that. And yes, I would love to be able to create more resources, whether that is video, whether that's in print or through whatever media we have available, be able to have more access to understanding religious trauma, spiritual abuse, how it impacts people, how it affects their lives, with their lives and their children and their marriages, that ripple effect. And so we'll see. I have ideas in my head, but other than writing this next book, nothing's 100% concrete, but I have lots of ideas. So
it sounds like you're just an absolute force to be reckoned with. You can't be slowed or stopped, which is amazing. And I'll be kind of watching from the sidelines to see when your book gets released and where things go next, which I think is really exciting. You did mention briefly that your other work is surprise DNA discoveries. So what does that work look like? Is it significantly different from what you do in the other part of your life, or does it ever overlap?
Well, it does overlap. So I'm a director with a nonprofit called NPE Friends Fellowship. We have about 11,000 members of our community. And everyone has taken an at-home DNA test and learned that someone is not actually related to them. Maybe their father or their mother is not actually their biological parent. And the NPE means not parent expected. And so that is our community of people. Who have experienced this identity trauma. So The overlap is there with the generational trauma, the identity trauma. And often people had grown up believing a lie. They'd always been told something that wasn't true. So there's another overlap where I can identify with this community. I myself am not an NPE, but I do have an aunt who discovered that my grandfather was not her biological father, and I have an uncle who found a son that he did not know existed.
Whoa.
And
okay.
So it has impacted my family personally, just not me. But now I'm a director with this nonprofit, and we host conferences, meetups. We also have a fund for DNA testing or for travel. We're heavily involved in research. There has been no research done behind the psychological or emotional impacts of discovering as an adult that your father or your mother is not actually your biological parent. And so we're actively involved in research. We've also helped, because there has been no research done, we partnered with a trauma recovery coaching organization, and we've developed a coaching program for those who are counselors or coaches to help individuals through this very specific NPE identity trauma. Wow. But once there's enough research done, we really have hopes of creating a recognized program for professional counselors.
That's incredible.
And so that's my other work in a nutshell, working with that community. But the common thread there is trauma and family hurt. And that is, again, why When Family Hurts became my first book, because I felt with both of the communities, the spiritual abuse and the DNA surprise community, that book could make the most impact for both of those communities right now.
Oh my goodness, Rebecca, you're just involved in the most amazing work. It's incredible. I don't even have anything to say. It's just amazing. It really is. The amount that you must give back to people. I'm not sure there's even a way to kind of scale it, but it just all sounds so great. I'll just again put all of these links in the episode description so that anybody can access easily any of the things we've discussed today that they think might be relevant, beneficial, helpful to them, or if you just want to know a little bit more to help other people. That's kind of how we keep these things moving forward as well, and how we highlight things and how we allow people that might not be aware of these things, how we help them to know that they do exist, is just by having these conversations and passing the information forward as well. So even if it's not relevant to you, just knowing that it's there could be really helpful to somebody one day. So I'll pop those all in the episode description.
And in our nonprofit community, we have individuals in over 40 countries. So a surprise genetic discovery is not just US, it's global. We have a large community of individuals in the UK, in Australia, majority in America, because that's where we are, but all over the world.
And before we finish up here today, there's just a few things that I wanted to ask you about your thoughts and feelings. I mean, of course, we've talked about the work that you do and how that might help people. But if there is somebody listening today that they themselves or a loved one is going through this spiritual identity disruption, their own journey through deconstruction, what advice would you give them in assisting them to maybe understand better what is happening to them, where to start in terms of understanding what is happening to them? Or maybe if somebody is just struggling with that particular journey, where they might go or what they might do to help themselves continue to heal.
Yeah. Oh, I think my first thing is it's gonna hurt. It's gonna be hard. But I can promise you it's gonna be worth it. You are dismantling perhaps decades or centuries of toxic, twisted, whether it's theologies or family patterns. Perhaps it's maybe some racism or something political comes up. Things in yourself that you didn't know you believed. And it's going to hurt and it's going to be hard and there are going to be unexpected twists and turns. There's going to be stuff that you don't know how to deal with. But the wonderful thing about going through this today is you don't have to be alone. There's people like me, and I'm not the only one that's in this space. There are great licensed therapists. There are some good coaches. There are people that have stepped in, and either they've experienced it themselves or they're trying to help. And you don't have to walk it alone. I would say that you do need to find someone to talk to. Find a therapist, find a coach, find someone else going through this, join a group online, find some books to read. Your brain is going to explode for a while. You may not feel safe for a while. You might be scared. So I walk my clients through faith, fear, and future. Faith is where we were, where we started from. This is the faith I had. This was the belief system I had. This is what I thought was a reality. This is what I thought was truth. And then what comes next is all the fears, all the questions. So we have to process those. And then we move into what's next. What is our future? What does the future look like? Where are we going? How do we want this to look like? What are we afraid it's going to look like? What do things look like when we let go of a belief? What would happen if we let go of this teaching or this belief? What would happen if I lose my family? What happens if I lose my marriage? What happens if there isn't a God? What happens if I stay a Christian? There's all of these different questions that we now have to process through, but you don't have to be alone. And admitting that you grew up in a cult or that your beliefs are cultish may be one of the hardest things that you ever do. Saying, my father was abusive. My brother abused me. My pastor abused me. Admitting those things is the other hard thing that you will have to do. But sometimes it takes a while before we even recognize that we were in a cult or that we were abused, because we've been conditioned to think that this is normal. We've been conditioned to think that that was okay, that you deserved it. And so you can't go alone. I tried that for the longest time because there were no resources. There was no help. I would look for cult counselors, like cult recovery. I couldn't find anybody. And maybe Google has improved, or my word searches have improved. I know now the terminology to use, but find resources, read those resources. But then, as I alluded to kind of at the beginning of this talk, slow down. I had a client one time call me. She was in a panic because she was like, well, there's BLM, the abortion, and then there's LGBTQ issues, and then there's, you know, does hell exist? And And she was in this frenzy because I don't know what to believe and I don't know how to do it and I want to do it right. And I calm down. So we've been conditioned again for all of these things, these teachings over here. And we're going to see it in the news. We're going to see it in the media. We're going to hear it from our friends. And you want this to be something organic. You don't want this to be a knee-jerk reaction. And your first reaction is that pendulum swing. Again, it's human nature. Here's what you believed before, and you're going to want to swing all the way over. I knew a family once who, they were Christian fundamentalists, but they dressed in a more Mennonite tradition. The women had the head coverings all the way up to their necks. Their whole bodies were covered. And literally, in less than 1 month, the mom and the daughters were at the beach wearing bikinis. So again, while that is not necessarily a bad thing, a wrong thing, it happened so quickly that that was not a healthy thing for their family, for them, because that pendulum swing, it moved. So you're going to be tempted to just move so quickly to another thing, but you need to make sure it is organic. It is something real. And so there is a movement of people who believe once you deconstruct, you must have a faithful reconstruction. And I disagree with that. And it gets me in trouble sometimes, but I disagree with that because if I so systematically rebuild and reconstruct, isn't that exactly what I just deconstructed? So I don't want to build a system because I am so afraid of a belief or an idea or a teaching that I now have to deconstruct what I just reconstructed years later. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So if you don't do this cautiously, slowly, with intention, you will find that you've rebuilt a system that you may have to deconstruct yet again. So don't rush into this reconstruction thing because it needs to take time. My process has taken me 14 years. Mm-hmm. And there are still things. I mean, literally last month, there was some major issue that I changed my mind on. But it took me that long because I had to make sure that it was something that I believed, why I believed it. And yeah, there's still fear. But that knee-jerk reaction will be to swing over and believe the exact opposite of everything you were ever taught. And so don't go this alone. Look out for that pendulum swing. Find a community of people or a person that you can talk to. It will take a toll on relationships. And it will probably be right those right around you first. If you're married or with someone, it could be your partner and your children. And then it kind of can go out. I do a talk on how religious trauma impacts the family. And it's that nucleus is you. There's you in the center. So what's that ripple effect look like? Again, whoever you're living in your house with often is the first. And then outside of that, your parents, your siblings, the people you grew up with, your extended family, your aunts, your uncles, your grandmas. But people are going to come out of the woodwork and go, oh, thank goodness. Be so grateful that you no longer believe these things. You know, or a friend who was always there, but they knew that you had some strange beliefs. So you will find allies that you did not expect. But again, it will hurt. It will be hard, but there are enough. I got out, shares a lot of the survivor stories and how after I did the hard work and faced the traumas and faced the fears and put in the work, here's my success story. Here's mm-hmm. what it looks like on the other side. And so find some of those people, find some of those stories. And it's worth it because no one should control your mind. No one should control your emotions, whether that's the media, whether that's a person, whether that's a philosophy. And so free will is important. The freedom to make decisions for yourself, the freedom to change your own mind when given new information. And it feels uncomfortable and it doesn't feel natural, but it should be. So I don't know. It's kind of, I wish I could give you one or two little things, but it's such a complicated, your whole person, your whole being, your mind, your body, like every part of you is involved in this. But you're looking for truth. You're looking for freedom. And it doesn't mean freedom to go live whatever the heck lifestyle that you decide, yeah, I'm just throwing it all away. I'm doing whatever I want. That's not necessarily what this means. mm-hmm. because then you are out of control. That's a reaction. That's a reaction to things. But look out, just learn yourself and have a guide and a support along the way.
So you're not alone. Slow down and don't rush. Mm-hmm. And go and check out some of these resources that we've spoken about today, because the work is amazing. And I'm really looking forward to actually running your book, When Family Hurts, as part of the memoir giveaway campaign at some point, which will probably be in 2023 now, because there are just so many books that I have in my catalogue to run the monthly memoir giveaways for. But there will be a time where I do feature Rebecca's work as the featured book of the month. And I'm really looking forward to it, especially to order a physical copy and see what it looks like.
Well, when you do see the cover of it, and anyone who grew up in IBLP, they get the reference. There is an umbrella on the front. And that was that core teaching, that umbrella of authority. And if you remove yourself from under that umbrella, you will be hurt. You will be assaulted. Satan will come after you. Something bad will happen. And so there is that nod to those people who have been hurt in that way. When family hurts, there's that umbrella. Yes, but once you've been through that hurt, there can also come hope. And I've been through that before. So that's me holding the umbrella like, yes, I get the irony, I know. But I want to help you find that hope, because I've been through that hurt. So here comes the hope.
And just to kind of wrap up, I know that we've mentioned this already, but just as a reminder before we end the episode today, where can everybody find you, your work, and everything that you're involved in?
Well, my website is RebeccaDrumsta.com. Rebecca is the old Hebrew version, so R-E-B-E-K-A-H, RebeccaDrumsta.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram and Facebook. Check out the Vashti Initiative, VashtiInitiative.org, NPE Friends Fellowship, and Preacher Boys, and I Got Out, and all of these amazing resources that can help you no matter what you're navigating in your life right now.
Incredible. And When Family Hurts, available today. I'm sure it's on some, I looked on the Big Giant, and it's on the Big Giant. But if you want to look in some smaller, more independent places, I'm sure that you can find it as well. If you don't want to support the corporate machine, which I know some people when it comes to books.
I know. You can order it through my website too, if you want to come through me. You can do bulk orders through my publisher. Or yes, anyone can order the books. You go to your small corner bookstore and they'll be able to order it for you.
Incredible. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your time. Thank you for changing things around and talking to me from your RV.
Absolutely.
On your family holiday.
Yeah.
I really appreciate all of your time and just all of the work that you're doing, the insight that you've given us today into your work, allowing me to read a copy of your book, When Family Hurts, and just coming here to give people some really nice nuggets of advice and insight into how they can help themselves, and almost through how you've helped yourself, which I think is amazing. I appreciate you. I appreciate your work, and I really hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. It was wonderful meeting you.
Take care, Rebecca. Speak to you soon.
Alrighty. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram @cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault Podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.